HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 113, recorded live Thursday, May 15th, 2008. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. Support is also provided by .NET Developers Journal, the world's leading .NET developer magazine. Online at www.sys-con.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Owen Rogers, one of the original authors of CruiseControl.net, about extending continuous integration with continuous monitoring.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'm sitting here with Owen Rogers of the Small Energy Group, formerly of ThoughtWorks and one of the founders of CruiseControl.net. Now, I've done a couple of shows before on continuous integration, but the opportunity to sit down with one of the founding members of the CruiseControl.net project was too great to pass up, so I appreciate you sitting down with me today.
Thanks, Scott.
So you had said that there's some history going on about the CruiseControl.net project, and it was more difficult to actually get out into the world than maybe a lot of us realize.
Yeah, so I started with CruiseControl.net back in 2002. So right at the time when I joined ThoughtWorks, ThoughtWorks was embarking on building a relationship with Microsoft, and they wanted to demonstrate what some of these tools were that they were working on in the Java open source space for Microsoft. So it was quite serendipitous for me. I came into ThoughtWorks with a bit of .NET experience, and I was involved in leading a team of four other developers in Calgary working on the initial release of CruiseControl.net. So what we did was get CruiseControl.net up to a level where it was sufficient to be demonstrated to Microsoft, and then we took it from there. Once we achieved that goal, then there was a bit of a dilemma for ThoughtWorks to deal with, which is what do we do with this product? Do we take it? Do we open source it? Do we turn it into something that is potentially saleable? And so there was quite a bit of debate internally about whether to take it and release it as open source or not.
Fortunately, how does a project get spun up, though, without an expectation of how it's going to actually leave the mothership?
Well, it achieved the objective, which was to credentialize ThoughtWorks within Microsoft and demonstrate what the value was associated with some of these things that we were quite excited about within the Java space. The question was then, how do we best capitalize on this investment? Because it had been built up on ThoughtWorks time. So there was myself and the other individuals that were involved were not assigned to a project, hence not billing out, not deriving revenue directly for ThoughtWorks over that period of time. So ThoughtWorks was debating how to best take advantage of this. And so thinking that, okay, being in the Microsoft space was different than being in the Java space. People typically sold products within the Microsoft space. Should we follow suit and in turn try and sell CruiseControl.net or leverage it to our strategic advantage for new .NET engagements? We could go in and we could say, okay, we have this tool that we're able to get up and running for you very quickly, and it provides these benefits, etc. Fortunately, as I said before, the clear heads prevailed, and the decision was made to open source the product.
And this has been a product that, for me, this was kind of like the first product that I used short of NANT, which I was using to drive. I was driving NANT with cruise control that really got me into this whole, what I think of as the alternative .NET space. It's the thing that holds it all together. But I remember trying to sell it to my bosses, sell in air quotes, telling my bosses that we should use cruise control. A lot of them were saying, well, why you should just use a batch file and just schedule it. Why would I want to use cruisecontrol.net or any kind of continuous integration server and not just a PowerShell script or a batch file on a schedule?
Well, it's very much been the kind of thin edge of the wedge as far as agile adoption is concerned.
Yeah, that's
from
a really
my experience.
Good way to put it.
So often, I work predominantly as an agile coach. Actually, very little of what I do deals with cruisecontrol.net itself. Mm-hmm. More often than not, if it's used at all, my experience with cruisecontrol.net is used to help win an engagement with a client that is looking to get their automated integration environment set up and running. And then things very much proceed from there. Because generally, you can go in and you can set up cruisecontrol.net relatively quickly. And then it's like, okay, now what's your biggest problem? So it's nice because it's relatively uncontroversial. Everybody can look at it and say, daily builds are a good idea. What happens if we make them more frequent? Well, that's got to be twice as good or many times as good. So it's a very easy way to enter into an engagement with clients. ThoughtWorks didn't necessarily recognize it as such. ThoughtWorks, despite its public reputation as being a company that promotes open source products, has got a fairly scanty reputation of harvesting open source projects internally. Instead, it leverages it to its advantage. It's somewhat controversial internally.
Well, it's a business, right? I mean, ultimately, they're trying to make the money and pay the rent at some point.
You're exactly right, which is that there was never really a clear business model for ThoughtWorks about how do we derive revenue directly from the open source assets that the company had acquired or built up. So the link was always accepted as being somewhat tenuous. And plus, with open source being open source, there was generally the willingness of suckers like myself to invest a lot of time outside of regular work hours, billable hours, in order to build up and enhance this product.
It sounds like a lot of people put a lot of work into it. I mean, there's a great deal of effort and heart and soul poured into cruisecontrol.net.
So I don't know if you know about Olo. It's an open source repository of metadata about different open source projects.
Oh, it's pronounced Olo?
I don't know how it's pronounced.
I
always assumed it was pronounced Olo.
Okay, but yeah.
O-L-O-H, I think.
Yeah, O-L-O. Excuse me, O-O-L-O-H.
Now, there's only one O.
There's only one O?
O-L-O-H.net, I think. Anyway.
We'll certainly put that up on the show site. But yeah, it's a spider that looks at an open source project, looks at check-ins, looks at your repository and says, if these many people worked on it in this many hours and this many lines of code, this project is worth X number of dollars. It provides some pretty interesting and creative statistics about a project's activity.
So I believe, and this is off the top of my head, that the report from Olo says that cruisecontrol.net equates to 62 man years worth of effort. So it's pretty substantial. I don't know exactly how they derive that information. I believe that it's related to the number of committers over the course of the lifetime of the project. But it's certainly not insignificant. I mean, at this point in time, cruisecontrol.net is the de facto automated integration server for the .NET platform. It's had over 80,000 downloads. So it's used in thousands of teams globally. So it's definitely achieved its share of success.
So I still have to push the original question. It's better than batch files. Why?
It's better than batch files. Why? It's better than batch files because people often talk about an automated integration server as being, well, it's nothing other than a while loop.
Right. True.
Why do
keep
you
building?
Exactly. Why do you need a tool around it? And admittedly, while that's true, there's a lot more that it does for you. One is it does provide integration with a large number of source control systems and different build tools. It provides a mechanism not only for it to just continuously pull your repository, you can also do things like schedule builds. You can have many builds running simultaneously. You can set up queues so that you can ensure that there is some sort of exclusion between builds. So if you've got builds that both depend on a common resource, or if you want to throttle back the number of builds that are happening concurrently on a machine, you've got that ability. Plus, there's all the reporting around it. And that's a big part of it, is that if it's just a batch file that's running in isolation, then it's not really providing feedback. And feedback is the core, is the essence of an automated integration server.
Ah, okay. So the feedback and the reporting and what comes out of it and what we do with that information is more important than the simple fact that the build ran and we scheduled it at a certain time.
Definitely. And actually, I would say that a product like cruisecontrol.net or Cruise Control or any of the other automated integration servers out there are, the value is secondary relative to the associated feedback. Often I go in and I talk to a client and they say, oh yeah, we're doing continuous integration. We've got cruisecontrol.net running. Meanwhile, they haven't had a passing build in weeks. and they're certainly not practicing anything along the lines of continuous integration. They're checking in very infrequently. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it's more about the practice, and the tool enables the practice. But it's important to separate the two, because you can certainly practice continuous integration without having the support of an automated integration server. It just makes it easier. That's why, I don't know if you notice when I'm talking about it, I refer to cruisecontrol.net as being an automated integration server rather than a continuous integration server, because I think of continuous integration as being what people do. It's the practice. And that is something that is supported by having an automated integration server in place.
That's a subtle but very powerful distinction. It's one thing to automate, but to apply the practices and, you know, the appropriate amount of respect to the data that is coming out and to act on it and improve your process. Certainly a broken build does no one any good. At my last company, we built a build server of build servers. It was basically a super dashboard by aggregating. At the end, I think we ended up with 35 or 40 different cruise control build servers because we had all these different projects. And there wasn't a sense of the health of the organization. Well, each project knew what their health was. The organization needed it because there was that remoting interface in cruise control that I think was then changed to be a more version independent interface. We made a super dashboard where someone could look and say, you know, gosh, this whole section of the building is looking rather healthy, but, you know, there hasn't been a good build in days over on these guys. And the project manager could then have a dashboard. He didn't need to see the check-ins. He didn't need to see the details, but he could get a sense of the way he segmented his organization and the builds within the suborgs and then what their health was.
That's really cool to hear. I mean, one of the things that's really exciting about this being an open source project is going out and talking to other people that are using the tool. And I often find and talk to people like yourself that have been using cruisecontrol.net for far more projects than I had ever dreamed that people would use the tool for. And the sort of extensibility you're talking about is exactly why we built the web dashboard with a RESTful API, because we recognized that the sort of interface that we would provide to cruisecontrol.net was not sufficient in and of itself, and that people would naturally want some sort of mechanism to extend it.
Well, and I've seen more and more projects that are not just producing bin files and, you know, DLLs rather than dropping them in a bin folder, but producing virtual machines as the result of a build, such that a salesperson could stop by and pick up that day's daily build, which the build artifact is a virtual machine. And we've taken, at the last job, cruise control even farther, such that we also fire up those virtual machines and run integration tests on them. So the build is one thing. The test pass is another. We also had things like code coverage, Symian for similarity analysis, and then going out all the way to firing up a VM, starting a test, using like Water or Watton to automate the browser inside of the VM, and then, saying, this is a good build, shutting it down, putting it into a library of virtual machines, all orchestrated by cruise control. And then also, the thing that I thought was the most powerful was the idea of what is failure became a really, really important thing at my last company. The idea that we could say this much coverage is minimal, or this many tests. When you check something in, there must be a test. And we started coming up with all new different ways to fail the build that were more than just saying a compiler error occurred.
Yep. There are many different factors that go into assessing the health of a build. I think that that's really interesting what you're talking about in terms of virtualization. I think that that's definitely the next wave that's coming for automated integration support. I know that some tool support is happening in that area, not specifically with cruisecontrol.net. I'm assuming that you at your company would have had to do quite a bit of custom work in order to get that up and going. But I think in the future, that's going to be much, much easier for companies to spin up a bunch of virtual machines, distribute their build across a grid that will run and test that build that's been created in a variety of different environments.
It was fairly Rube Goldbergian in its design, but we had a COM interface for a virtual server 2005. And I assume that some of the virtualization stuff in 2008 will have WMI or similar interfaces, but it's still pretty obscure, and it was considered pretty advanced. And we had our continuous build so that someone would check in, which is an interesting thing to point out. Actually, talk to me about it's not just that we're scheduling builds. Like, let's say I check something into Subversion or into my source control. Cruise control's polling, right? And then what happens if I check in immediately afterwards? Are we seeing builds on every single check-in?
Not by default. So by default, cruisecontrol.net will, because of the nature of it polling the version, your version control repository on a periodic basis, it may aggregate a couple of check-ins together if those check-ins have come in fairly close in sequence. A big part of it depends on the length of your build process. So if you've got a very long-running build process, then you're more likely to get a bunch of check-ins within that single build. There are other tools. So SYN, for example, is a relatively obscure automated integration server. It's built entirely on top of Subversion.
It's called SYN?
Yeah, S-I-N, SYN. Oh, wow. It was designed to support a model where the build would never ever break. So each developer would always check in on a new branch, and the automated integration server would take responsibility for merging those branches into trunk. And that would ensure that it was only pulling in one change set at a time. I mean, what cruisecontrol.net does do is it tracks what the last, at least in the example of Subversion, tracks the last change set and then determines if what new change sets have been added in the interim since the last build happened. I mean, ideally, you should be keeping your builds to a sufficiently small interval. They should run sufficiently quickly that the likelihood of there being multiple commits included in a single build is reduced substantially. But from my experience, at least, having multiple commits in a single check-in is generally not such a big deal. I mean, you're really only talking about maybe two, maybe three commits, depending on the size of the team. And it's often pretty easy to determine which commit was responsible for causing a build breakage, so you can determine who has to deal with the aftermath.
Yeah, that idea that don't leave the building until you know that the build has succeeded became a really big part of the culture. And there were a couple of times where folks, myself included, would check something in on a Friday afternoon and then take off and not realize that the build was going to be broken. And we'd end up basically screwing everybody for the weekend who wanted to do any kind of work. And that became a big part of the culture. We actually bought an ambient orb, which was this crystal ball with lights that would light up based on whether or not the health of the build was a good thing, and put up, you know, signs and lights in prominent places so that people would know that the build was healthy.
I think the ambient orb is a good example, because what it does is it takes information out of the system and makes it accessible as part of the environment that people actually work in and interact in, so that you don't actually need to be logged into a system in order to see what the status is of a build. But I think that it only takes it a certain distance. There's so much more information that could be leveraged rather than just whether your orb is pulsating in green, yellow, or red. So for the Agile 2008 conference that's going to be here in Toronto in the start of August, I'm doing a session called Continuous Monitoring Beyond Continuous Integration. So what continuous monitoring is about is recognizing that the build is just one potential source of information about the health of a project. And it's something that we've invested a lot of time and effort into. It's certainly, for projects that have an automated integration server up and going, it is the heart and lifeblood of that project, but it only provides a subset of the possible amount of information about the health of a project. I mean, your build might be 100% green and passing all the time, but that may be covering up a host of other problems that you have. So there's many different sources of information about the health of a project, and part of what continuous monitoring is about pulling that information together and making it accessible in the same way that feedback was coming in from your ambient orb. So as I said before, the ambient orb is good but limited. Really, what you want is the flexibility of something like a wall-mounted display in order to be able to provide you with information about all of these other facets on your project. So this, for me, came as a realization from the last couple of projects where I've been on, where we have used a relatively low-spec computer that we've set up in the corner with a flat-screen monitor that we've been able to mount prominently, and we have aggregated information from the web dashboard for a number of different projects onto a single screen.
Mm-hmm.
And that provided the team with an alternative to the ambient OR because you could see more information, not just whether the bill was passing or failing, but what it was currently doing, what the last successful label was or what label it was currently building, etc. So there's just a ton more flexibility. And what we did from then was we started to plug into other sources of information on our project. So how many open bugs do we have in Jira?
What Jira being your bug tracking system.
Exactly. The issue tracking system that we were using on that project.
Mm-hmm. And all this is meant to provide a dashboard that indicates the health of the project. How are we doing? Should we panic?
It's to give a comprehensive understanding, a holistic understanding of the status of the project.
Okay.
So, I mean, health is, yeah, one description of
health. I guess I'm using the term health as kind of an aggregate for all of the different bits of information that let us know whether, action should be taken.
Exactly. And if you're not taking a look at those things, if those things aren't being presented in a way that's easily accessible to people, if you, in other words, have to go and log into Jira and see what the number of open issues are, then people are not going to be as willing to act on that as if it was something that was readily visible within their workspace.
So you're saying that if the information that they need isn't effortless, if there's any barrier to entry at all to get that information that they might need to make a particular decision, then they might just never do it.
Exactly. And the way to make it effortless is to make it ambient, to make it so that people can absorb that information passively without actually having to do something. It's part of their work environment. Their work environment is projecting information at them so that when the status changes of something that needs to grab their attention, then it is readily visible for members of the team. So going beyond the Jira example, number of open issues, there were other things like we were using an operations database, which is a topic that I talked about today at the conference. And the operations database held information about the performance of the system. So what were the slowest running operations? We were able to take that information and present that correspondingly within a dashboard.
This is part of an integration test?
So it's not
part
of an
integration. Where are you gathering
all this from? So, okay. The
reason I ask is
this is also a larger topic.
No, but still, it's a fantastic topic because one of the things that was happening with us is we kept trying to provide information to people and we would push out these reports and the email that we sent out after each build got longer and longer and longer to the point where people just ignored them. People would make rules to take the build server's email report and just put it directly in the trash because we made a rule company-wide that you must receive the build mail. But that, of course, doesn't mean that they have to read it.
Right. So if something shows up in your inbox, it's still very easy to ignore it, number one. Number two, things transmitted by email are naturally on a slower feedback cycle. So there's a larger disconnect between the point in time when something changes. So whatever that thing was that you're assessing, let's say code coverage, flipped from being acceptable to not acceptable. And the third thing is that you are reading it individually. There's no collective responsibility associated with that email. It was addressed to you. It's not clear who should take responsibility for something. Whereas if it's up and it's written on the wall or projected on the wall on a screen, it's very clear that this is something that the team as a whole has to deal with. Because anybody else who comes into that environment, they can see that this information is prominently displayed and they can see that there's a problem here. So the team has got an incentive to ensure that they're correcting it and dealing with it as soon as possible.
And starting to kind of, this starts to make sense to me full circle because coming at it from your point of view as an agile coach, all of this information is nothing without an appropriate process wrapped around it. And one of the fundamental things about agile that's so important to everyone is the notion of collective ownership.
Yeah.
And collective ownership is such an anathema to people who have previously had ownership over a subsystem that they designed during the big design up front and their waterfall process. But having something, like one of the things that's important about collective ownership, I think, is co-location. I've always felt that it's important to take everyone and put them in a bullpen. And that would be where you would put this giant screen.
That's right. But not necessarily, because of the fact that the information is accessible online. So you can easily take one of these monitors or dashboards and be able to display it remotely. So within ThoughtWorks, one of the things that I did a lot of work on was different distributed projects. I spent a year and a half working in India, 6 months working in China on different projects that had an offshore and onshore component to them. And so you can take one of these dashboards and install it at a client site or install it on sites for both teams. And all of a sudden, they're both looking at the same set of information.
Did you actually set up a screen for them? Get a big screen and put it up there for them?
No. So this is a new topic. And this is something that I think we're going to see a lot of development around in the next year or so.
Yeah.
So it's something that I think organizations are only starting to realize the value of. And there's a number of things that make it a little bit difficult to attain right now. One is that it requires the intersection between both software and hardware. So it's not simply about having a software tool that aggregates this information together, but it's also having a suitable display that you can install in an environment and have that working in a way that is easily accessible to a team. So, for example, if you're just looking at a flat screen monitor and a machine, it's often difficult to find space within a corporate environment in order to play something like that.
Certainly it's difficult to keep that machine logged in all the time and, you know, who's the user. One of the big issues we had with our cruise control servers, one of the biggest issues was, who's this running as? This is an identity. And this identity has to have access to network shares, and it's going to run automatic so that there's going to be some machine logged in all the time, whether it's logged into the desktop or whether the service has the ability to interact with the desktop. That was pretty fundamentally a big deal. Computers are typically in a corporate environment assigned to a human being. So now we're going to have one that's going to sit there in the corner and show its screen and no screensaver all the time?
Yep, exactly. And it becomes hard to justify the value of something like that. Like within most corporate IT shops, inventory is pretty carefully managed. And so if they see a machine that's sitting idle even for a moment, then it will be reallocated elsewhere. So really what you need is some sort of hardware that is fit to purpose. And what I've been looking at recently is ways in which you can have this wall-mountable flat-screen monitor displays with an integrated hardware component, so some sort of a mountable small computer, and provide that with network access, whether it be wireless or wired, ideally both, and that is your ambient display device. So then it's a device that's fit for purpose. There's no question about it being allocated elsewhere. It doesn't need to be high spec because it's really all it's doing is pulling in information from different sources within the enterprise.
It could just run a browser in kiosk mode.
Exactly.
And have the whole thing be Ajax calls. Let me take just a very brief moment and we'll thank our sponsors. We'll come back and we'll hear more about continuous monitoring. Hi, it's Scott Hanselman here. Hope you're enjoying the show so far. I'm coming at you from another place in time. Sorry to interrupt the show, but I want to let you know that putting together a podcast like this every week isn't free. The folks that pay the bandwidth bill is Telerik. They make the show possible, and they also make some pretty cool products like Telerik Sitefinity. It's a development platform for constructing websites, community portals, and intranets built all on ASP.NET 2.0, so you're using the various well-known goodies like master pages and membership services, data model provider, things that you already know. It's pretty flexible. You've got a very robust core that you can customize. You can plug in anything that you want from complex applications for a CRM or just a little widget that displays the weather. If you're not big into the code thing, that's cool too. You get a full set of features out of the box like workflow, multilingual sites, content versioning that can all be added without code. There's also a whole bunch of pluggable modules and components for news, blogs, forums, polls, lists. This is all stuff that you can do without code. And it's a pretty good-looking product as well. You've got a nice Web 2.0 administrative interface that lets you, as well as your boss who's not technical, be really productive. So check out Sitefinity.com, and we'll get you right back to the show. Thanks a lot. So you were talking about putting together a hardware. Was it a platform, or would this be a PC that we'd have hanging on the wall? Or would this be something embedded?
Well, so I've been looking at a couple of different options. One of the things I've been looking at recently are these things called gum sticks, which are mini computers about the size of a pack of gum that provide relatively low-spec computing power. They're quite inexpensive to acquire, and they could be directly affixed to one of these flat-screen mountable monitors. And they run... I mean, you can install what you want.
When you say
it.
A stick of gum, are you talking about like Juicy Fruit, like an actual stick of gum?
Yeah, exactly.
Like a USB key size computer.
Exactly.
That's creepy.
Yeah. So there's the companies in Vancouver that manufactures them. Mm-hmm. But there's other alternatives for display. Another thing that we've been looking at, and this is in conjunction with one of my colleagues, is rather than using a wall-mountable monitor, mm-hmm. you can use electronic photo albums. So picture frames.
Yeah, like a Siva.
Yeah, exactly.
Or Chumbi.
That are designed to display your photos. And some of the newer ones provide wireless access. So what you can do is you can push images to them. So
you could push it to Flickr for all they care.
Sure, you could push it to whatever you want.
That's
right?
So funny. Flickr as continuous integration service bus.
But I'm not sure if by Flickr, like if you're thinking about the same thing as I am, because I don't know some of the sites that you're just talking about.
What I'm saying is that you can go to the local Costco or the warehouse and buy for $100 a 10-inch digital picture frame.
That's right.
And you point it to your Flickr username, and it will start showing a slideshow instantly from the Flickr service on Yahoo.
Exactly.
And it'll pull it from any arbitrary RSS feed.
Yep.
And you can say to randomize it. Or you can get, I think it's called a Chumbi. And a Chumbi is a little 4-inch portable, looks like a little fancy alarm clock. It's an open Linux system. And you buy them for $120, and they sit on your desk. And you can point them to an arbitrary RSS feed.
And so that's exactly what I'm talking about.
And you're basically saying using existing ambient information devices from any one of the many different sources, some of which are, again, open platform, some are not, and using techniques like whether it be Flickr as platform or RSS or some custom code that you would write.
Exactly. And the goal is to keep it very low cost. So the digital photo frame is perfect because it is relatively inexpensive. It's something that most IT shops wouldn't bat an eye at going out and just acquiring.
Yeah.
And
Certainly easier than a 42-inch plasma.
As long as the software is there to back it up, so it's very simple to mm-hmm. plug in and install, you've got a display of what your dashboard is up and going, then that provides the hardware end of things. So that's where I see that there is really an opportunity here, because it is this intersection between both the hardware requirement of being mm-hmm. able to display this information ambiently and the software side of things, which integrates and aggregates this information from all the different information sources on a project.
I think that the idea of having it not be a PC that someone could log into and allowing someone to lock it down simply by MAC address and saying, we will give you access to this XML endpoint, you can do gets to this port 80, is about as locked down as one could ever hope for an appliance within a corporation to be.
Yeah.
The key, of course, is getting the people to understand that it's more than just the device. It's about the information that the device provides and how to act on that.
Right.
And how do you act on that? And you're using this to sell Agile, basically. As you said, I like the way you phrased it before, that continuous integration servers were the thin edge of the wedge.
That's right.
You're using
for
this
Agile
to kind of crowbar your way into an organization, because who could possibly complain about a continuous build?
Right, exactly. And then once you've got a continuous build, well, what else can I do with it?
Oh, it's an idea virus.
I can increase its values by adding some tests or mm-hmm. adding in some static code analysis or whatever.
I'm continually impressed when I visit companies and they have the big glass wall that lets you see the data center that they run there. Rather than having the data center buried somewhere, I used to work at a company called 800.com, and they put the data center in the center of the warehouse, and it was like in the middle of this giant glass tube. And you could look in there and see the flat screens that showed the health of the system. They displayed their perfmon stats with pride. You know, if they could make an electronic t-shirt that would show the number of visitors, that was the kind of culture it had. And this was 10 years ago.
And that's also the sort of information that I'm talking about aggregating through continuous monitoring. And that was partially the topic of the session that I did today about the operations mm-hmm. database, is starting to collect that information that is available within an operations environment and make it more accessible within the organization as a whole, certainly within the development side of the IT organization, because the development side is actually capable of acting on it. So from my experience, within many organizations, things like uptime is not something that developers generally know about. Whereas if this information was being displayed continuously as part of the work environment, then it would be much more accessible to developers. It would be much more real. And one of the challenges that I've run into within many organizations is that there is this division between development and operations. And they tend to be in conflict because they're measured in accordance with different goals. Development is assessed on the basis of being able to release fully featured software into production on time.
Mm-hmm.
Operations is measured on the basis of production system stability and uptime. But the two are fundamentally in conflict because there's nothing that is more destabilizing to a production environment than to accept a new release. So from the operations perspective, if you're not being measured on the basis of new functionality coming into your environment, then what are you going to do? You're going to erect barriers and say, okay, there has to be this sort of a rigid change management process associated with every new release that we accept into production. And conversely, from the development side of things, if the system is failing within production, you may not know about it. You may not need to know about it. There's often forces within the organization that would keep you from knowing about that because it would be distracting from focusing on whatever the new set of features are that you're currently working on.
That's interesting that it seems that some developers have a sense of ownership over the package that they deliver, but not the actual thing that's in production. And there seems to be a culture of information hiding in this industry. I mean, it seems that in the manufacturing industry, they proudly show signs that say 400 days since our last accident, which is their equivalent of uptime, or we're currently making a car every 12 seconds. But I usually don't see signs up and flat screen monitors up outside of data centers that are touting, you know, we're at 5.9s right now. It seems like that should be broadcasted to the world. I'm always impressed when I enter an organization and not only have they got signs up near the data center, but in the lobby. You know, you want to impress me, put a 42-inch flat screen with a perfmon and some dashboard up in the lobby of your building.
That's the goal.
That's really powerful. What is the culture that's preventing people to do that?
Well, first off, I'm really glad that you mentioned the manufacturing example because that's partially where the inspiration for this came from. So I've been reading a lot recently about lean manufacturing and looking mm-hmm. for opportunities to apply ideas from lean into the software development
realm. So just to be clear to our folks that are listening, that lean doesn't just mean necessarily the concept of lean, but this is a practice. This is the name of something. Lean.
That's right. So it is a set of ideas that have helped revolutionize the manufacturing idea, and mm-hmm. it is embodied within the Toyota company. Toyota is where many of the lean ideas first came about.
Mm-hmm.
And so much of the lean terminology is in Japanese. So there's a lean concept called an Andon board, and an Andon board is exactly what I've just been describing.
Okay.
That's A-N-D-O-N. And within Toyota's manufacturing plants, there is a prominent display within the assembly area
mm-hmm.
where every production worker can see what the status is of the line. And so that information is visible. It is updated continuously, and it's what drives their process. It helps them ensure that they're practicing tech time, that they are meeting the necessary quality standards, that they're meeting the necessary levels of production that are required in order to sustain their lean operation. And it's exactly the same idea within software development, is to take and create Andon boards for software teams. That's the central idea behind continuous monitoring.
And this is an idea that you're just kind of working on right now. This isn't, I can't rush out and buy one of these, but I could start. How do I get involved in the conversation? I think that people who are listening to this are going to want to find, where's the Google group? Where's the website? Where's the blog? How do I get more information about continuous monitoring? What I can do to make this happen at my company today?
So at this point in time, it's pretty much under the radar.
Okay.
The easiest thing is to contact me directly at owen@exortech.com, exortech.com. And alternately come to Agile 2008, the start of August. I'm going to be doing a 3-hour tutorial on this topic, and we'll hopefully have more than just vaporware to present, at least from the software side, and provide some demos of integration mm-hmm. with hardware. The things that I've done on projects in the past have been more or less cobbled together. And so this is an attempt to extend beyond that and actually explore the interaction between the software and the hardware and see where these two things fit together.
Very cool. Well, thanks so much for sitting down with me today. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, no problem, Scott.
All right. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.